Today's Teisho will be on case 32 in the Book of Serenity, the Book of Equanimity. Case 32 is entitled Yang Shan's Mind and Environment. Introduction. The ocean is the world of dragons. Disappearing and appearing, they sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. Why does the exhausted fish stop in the shoals and a sluggish bird rest in the reeds? Is there any way to figure gain and loss? Case. Yang Shan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yang Shan said, "Do you think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yang Shan said, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thoughts. Think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get here, I don't see any existence at all." Yang Shan said, "This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of person." The monk said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yang Shan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you only get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After this, see on your own." Verse, all embracing with no outside, penetrating with no obstruction. Gates and walls like cliffs, doors and locks redoubled. When the wine is always sweet, it lays out for guests. Though the meal is filling, it ruins the farmers. Bursting out of the clear sky, the Garuda takes wing on the wind, treading over the blue sea, thunder follows the roaming dragon. This is day one of our January 2010 session, and I want to thank everybody for coming today, last night, and some of you came this morning, thank you for doing such a good job this morning in your sitting. Several days before the New Year, I went to see a movie which was called Avatar. Some of you may have seen it, and if you haven't, I think it's definitely worth going to. For one thing, you get a pair of 3D glasses which you can put on, and I have a pair now. I'll keep it on the shelf waiting for the next 3D movie. And it was, the special effects were interesting. I mean, I thought it was kind of a gimmicky idea to have 3D glasses and so on. But when I went to the movie, it was really quite an experience visually. The critics were the critics weren't very excited about the movie. They said the technology is great, the special effects were great, but the plot is not very interesting, not a very good plot. And so they were pretty yawning, you know, pretty ho-hum about the plot. But the movie apparently has already made like $1 billion in profits. And it's been successful all over the world. I think that Mr. Cameron, the director of the film, is really quite a good storyteller. And he also has, I think, insight into human nature. He also directed the Titanic movie. Some of you probably saw that. And the Titanic was, you know, really a beautifully constructed movie, I thought. It was such a simple, sort of like elemental plot about two people from different classes who meet on this boat as disaster strikes. And they have this love affair in a very brief period. And basically the Titanic goes down, and she survives, and he dies taking care of her in the water. And the story's told now that she's a very old woman. And there's something elemental about the story because, you know, it's about young people who don't fully understand the world, who grow up in a world that doesn't necessarily make sense. And they're both, in a way, like prisoners of their society, you know. So the woman is being courted by this rich and powerful man who turns out to be kind of a villain, not a very nice man, and a manipulator. And she's sort of a prisoner of her middle class background, her upper middle class background. And the boy she falls in love with is this Irish boy who's traveling on a different class, you know, very like down in the bottom of a ship. There's the working class immigrants. And they meet, and there's some spark between them, even though they're from different classes and different cultures. And they throw caution to the wind, and they fall in love, and violate many rules. As I recall, they sleep together, and so on. So the thing is that, you know, they break a lot of rules, and they experience this extraordinary, they experience life very richly in a way they never expected to. And then there's this astonishing calamity that was totally unpredictable. And somehow their love for each other is able to sustain them through this calamity right to the end. And the fact that they stay together and stick together tells us something about who they are as people. You know? So I think the story of the Titanic is easy to dismiss, but it's really quite a powerful, there's great insight into human life. Maybe because it's so elemental, it might seem a little trivial. You know, two people on this boat, they fall in love, and the boat goes down, and most of the action is about, you know, the boat and all the people drowning and so on and so on. But there's these wonderful moments in the movie where people demonstrate great compassion or great calm in the midst of a disaster. So for example, there are these musicians who have really given up their chance of leaving because there's not enough lifeboats for everybody. So they've decided not to pursue escape, and they just keep playing their instruments until it's no longer possible to play, you know. I just think that's so beautiful. You know, there's such a nobility in that story. So I have a lot of respect for him, even though he made $1 billion. I'm sorry that I wasn't involved in that project in any way. He is a really good movie maker, Mr. Cameron. And this new movie also, the critics kind of went ho hum, you know. But actually, if you haven't seen it, you should probably see it. You know, I don't want to give away too much of the movie, but it's about sort of a quote unquote like primitive people who live on this planet, on this moon that's habitable. And basically, they are deeply, their way of life is deeply intertwined with the natural world. So that they have, they have like almost like a seamless relationship with the natural world. They have sacred trees, and they have rituals that involve nature. And they're really like hunters, like hunter-gathering people. And they are on a planet that has very precious metal that Mr. Cameron calls unobtainium, to make sure everybody understands that it's really precious. And they're like people who come from Earth who want this metal and are going to have to push these people, these quote-unquote primitive people, out of the way. And they're very familiar types, you know, because they're business people and they're soldiers. And they have huge spaceships, and the soldiers are all like muscle men. And they're big brawny guys, very tough, and they have very serious weapons, very, very deadly weapons. And they fly around in these things that look like Humvees, but they fly through the air. And they have tanks and so on that fly through the air. So it's quite familiar, right? It's like this is our history in a way. Because, you know, the native people, they're called the Nabi, are a lot like American Indians. And these people are like modern versions of ourselves. And the Navi have like a deep connection to nature. And the Earth people are simply interested in profit and exploiting the planet. And there's a romance there too. There's an interspecies romance. And I was just thrilled by the movie because I realized that there was something highly romantic about it. You know, that there's these Navi people, first of all, are very interesting. They're blue, and that makes them interesting. And they don't seem to be any Navi villains. You know, they just seem to be all sort of good guys. And so it's a little bit unfair. But all the same, I think it has done so well, not just because of the special effects, but because there's something really like elemental about this story. You know, there's something elemental about this this story, about people who live close to the natural world and feel a deep kinship with it. You know, deep. It turns out they have like a long ponytail, but it's not just a ponytail, it's like a plug. And they can plug it into plants and trees and things and commune with the energy of life. And it turns out that the plants themselves are sentient, that somehow they've developed a nervous system that allows them to have some kind of an awareness. They have electrical conductivity, and so they have something like a nervous system, even the trees. Plus, there are floating islands and things like that make it even cooler. But, you know, the thing that resonates most deeply is this idea that these are people who are deeply connected to the natural world. And we can recognize ourselves in the soldiers and business people who come to despoil that world. And, this is a movie that was made while we were occupying Iraq and so on. So it resonates on many levels. It's sort of our history today. It's the history of the United States. And it's about all of those things. When I was growing up, I was very much a big fan of the Native Americans. And I remember reading Indian from the Plains. And he was being interviewed by some reporter, and he said, you know, when European settlers came here, people from the West, from Europe, came here, they kept calling this the Wild West. And he said, but we never thought of it as wild. We always thought of it as our home. Yeah. And those kinds of observations moved me very deeply. I was very impressed by that. I realized that Indians were, you know, a violent people. You know, they fought wars with each other. They weren't saintly and compassionate all the time. But nevertheless, there was something about their connectedness with the natural world I found very appealing. You know. And I think there have been people in the world who have had a deep, deep relationship with the natural world, you know, really profound, much, much deeper than we understand, because we live in a very, we live in a highly mechanized and artificial society. You know. People spend hours and hours a day in front of their computer or in rooms that are, myself too, you know, rooms that are heated and that have, fluorescent lights and so on. And I have a friend of mine who teaches a course called Writing as a Naturalist. It's about nature writing, and the students read some nature writing, and then we try to ask them to do some writing about nature. And my friend was telling me that a lot of the students that he has in the course, they don't really like to go outside that much, you know. And I thought that was interesting, but I'm not surprised, because our culture, it doesn't really encourage that kind of thing, you know. I was reading the other day that attendance at national parks is declining. It hasn't falling off like precipitously. It isn't like suddenly dropping rapidly, but it is going down. And I think that's another symptom of the way our culture is going. You know, you never drive down a street in New Jersey and see a billboard that says "Pursue enlightenment." You know, try to wake up. That just never happens. When I see that billboard, I will know a real social change has happened, right? Generally, it says, it's an advertisement. The closest, I did see a billboard as I was driving on Route 1 that said, it said Hitoku, which is a word for Buddha. And I saw it and I thought, what? And then it turns out it's a restaurant, right? It's called the Hitoku Restaurant. I think it might have gone out of business, but it was a fancy, expensive Japanese restaurant. So it hasn't happened yet, you know. So the culture doesn't send us certain kinds of signals. It doesn't say enlightenment is really important. If you lived in, say, the 14th century, 15th century Japan, or in China at many periods in its history, or if you lived in Tibet, you would be getting messages all the time that the pursuit of awakening was a worthy goal, right? but not in our culture. And the same is true for the natural world. We don't really get messages that say, you know, go out and look at a tree today, you know, or go out and watch birds today, you know. That's just not part of the culture. So people grow up, I think, somewhat disconnected, but even though that's true, I think this movie has been successful because there's something about this idea of getting in touch with the world that really, really means something, even now, even in this highly artificial way of life we've made. There's something about the idea of connecting deeply with things that is still appealing. It's a little bit crazy that people have to get this insight from going to a movie theater, right? So, you know, basically we go to a movie theater and we put on 3D glasses and there's this cool movie about these people who live in a tree, a giant tree, and about how cool nature is. Many of these people might never go to a park and see a tree or go to say Yosemite or places where there really are amazing natural vistas and so on, but they go to the movie, and in the movie it says be part of the natural world, and I think people think, yes, that would be really nice. And it's hard, of course, because of the modern world. I left the theater, and then I was in the mall on Stelton Avenue, and I drove home, and there was a lot of traffic and so on. But nevertheless, I think there's something about this idea of connecting with the world which is really very powerful, and I think that's one of the reasons Mr. Cameron's movie, you know, made like $1 billion in a month, because people all over the world have this hunger for connection. And I think that this is one of our best hopes, really, one of the best hopes for the future, you know, is that, that people do have this hunger for connection. And I think that Zen is one way, and a really wonderful way, that people can respond to this need for connection. You know, we're isolated from the natural world in many different ways. And we're also isolated in many different ways from one another, you know. A friend of mine, when I was in college, I was studying Arabic. And I studied Arabic with a man named Mohammed Swayeya, who was from North Africa. And Mohammed was very lonely in the United States because people are so isolated here. And I didn't know what he was talking about because I grew up in the United States. But he said, in his village, which was called El Kef, where he grew up, people were constantly socializing. And, if people thought nothing of coming over to somebody's house, you know, like unannounced, and they might just stay all night, you know. And in the summer, people would put their beds up on the roof of the house. They had flat-roofed houses because it's very dry. And it would be cooler up higher. And so, you know, somebody might come to your door at 7 o'clock at night and say, "Hi, how are you?" And you say, "Come in and have some tea." And they make tea with almonds and loads of sugar. And you might stay up talking, and then they might stay overnight. It might even stay for a couple of days, you know. He said this was going on all the time. And it sounded wonderful, you know. Now, he and his wife, Peggy, became friends of mine and my wife, Barbara. But after a while, they drove us crazy, you know, because they were coming over all the time. And, I mean, literally, it was like, here comes Saturday was coming, and it's like, well, so what are we going to do on Saturday? You know, what do we do with Peggy and Muhammad? You know, there was no Saturday where we weren't all together, and we liked them, but after a while it became claustrophobic for us. So it was like we reached a cultural limit. You know, I couldn't cross that bridge totally. You know. And it our friendship never quite recovered, actually, because Muhammad took it personally, even though I said, you know, I really like you, but we need a little space, you know, and that didn't handle that well. I don't know how I could have handled it, but anyway, I think we do feel, you know, we like our space, but I do think many people who come to this country from other places notice how kind of isolated we are from one another, as well as from the natural world, you know. So, anyway, I think Zen is really a wonderful practice of connecting with things. You know, even though you might not think it's about connection, it really is quite a bit about connection. We come in and sit down on a cushion, and we close our eyes, and we don't move for hour after hour. And you might think this is the very opposite of connecting with the world, right? It's the very opposite. In a way, you know, we really withdraw from the world, you know. So we're not out hiking in the woods. We're sitting on these cushions, and we're watching the breath, and eventually the mind can become very empty and blank. And many people think of meditation as a kind of world evasion or world denial. You know, and it looks that way. It really does look that way. You know, why aren't we out kayaking? If we're so big on nature or connection, why aren't we out kayaking and so on and so on? But it's interesting that our separation from separation from nature is really a big problem, and our sense of separation from other things too. And it's not necessarily solved by being close to things physically, you know. I remember when I started got involved in backpacking and hiking when I was quite young. My father wanted to be a scoutmaster, and so he became the scoutmaster along with a man named Mr. Sayre on the base. And because my father thought that Boy Scouting was a good idea, he decided I should be a Boy Scout. And I really wasn't into it, but one of the things that I did enjoy was hiking. And we went on a couple of long hikes, like 50-mile hikes, as a scout troop. And one of the things we would hike about 7 or 8 miles a day, and then pitch our tents and make dinner and so on. It was so unlike the world that I had lived as a suburban kid, you know. Because I used to get up in the morning and watch TV or read, and I had chores to do. And I was on the swimming team, so I would sometimes get up early and have to go to swim practice, and then I'd come home and watch TV and do something, hang out, you know. And this was so different, you know, being out in the woods and sleeping in a tent on the ground. It was quite difficult for me, quite challenging to walk 7 miles every day with a pack on my back, too. And it was hot, you know, it was the middle of the summer, there was no air conditioning and so on. But something about it really appealed to me. It was really like, this is wonderful. You know, I felt wonderful, even though I didn't know why. And I even got sick. I gathered a bunch of wild blueberries with other people in the troop, and I ate a bunch and I had some kind of an allergic reaction and my face swelled up like a balloon and I felt very ill. But it was an extraordinarily interesting and exciting experience. It really has changed my life, probably more than anything except Zen. Later, when I was in college, I continued to hike, but I picked up a friend named Larry Sullivan, who later became a very good friend of mine. And Larry was a real city boy, you know. He had never done things like hiking or he grew up in suburban McLean, Virginia. But we went on a hike that was a disaster for him. It was like everything went wrong. But at the end of it, oddly, he wanted to do it again, you know, to my amazement. And we decided to go on a 50-mile hike together. We went on a 50-mile hike together, and eventually he became an incredible outdoors person. I mean, I just got a letter from him, and he hikes all over the place. He still is like this avid hiker, this real athlete. He loves being out in the natural world. So anyway, you know, Larry got into this in a big way, but at first he really didn't know what to do out there in the wild, and he was a philosophy major, you know. So when we would hike, we would talk philosophy, and we'd be hiking through the mountains of Virginia, through the Blue Ridge Mountains. And we'd be arguing furiously about some point in philosophy, you know. And I remember we'd get so excited about it. We'd get so heated up, and we'd be arguing furiously. And I remember we came around a corner, and somebody had apparently been watching us or listening to us. And he saw us, and he just burst into laughter. And I realized what he meant, because it's like we were paying no attention to the world around us. We were so lost in our philosophical debate, you know, that we had walked for miles and paid no attention to the world around us. So being there doesn't necessarily solve the problem. There's something about the way the mind works, the way the conscious mind works, that automatically distances us from the world. And so it's not so simple as to go out into the woods and you will feel connected. One of the things that always has always surprised me is that when I went out to the West, you know, when I went out to like Montana and New Mexico and places like that, a lot of the people there aren't really like into the natural world. They're not really interested in the natural world. They don't particularly like it, you know. And I think, how can you live in the midst of all this and not have a deep love for it, you know? But they don't, you know. They think of wolves as varmints, and they can't wait to get a Walmart in their town and things like that. And that just has astonished me, but it's because there's something about the conscious mind that creates a distance between ourselves and the world. And this is why, by the way, that even when people, you know, decide to go up to Alaska and live in a log cabin, it might not work out as they think, because they're still creating this distance between themselves and everything mentally, you know. So even though it might seem that we're closing ourselves off from the world, I don't think that's what we're doing. And I really don't. I think that the human relationship to the world is quite complex, because we have this mind that creates a distance, the discriminating mind creates a kind of distance between ourselves. So you know, as you know, as you might go out for a walk and you turn the corner and you suddenly see the sun going down, and for a minute, it's just gripping. It's like you disappear and you just become the sun going down. It's like your whole attention is riveted on the moment. And there's this deep sense of connection to things, right? It can be astonishing, right? It can be really wonderful. It's like being lifted out of yourself, you know? And then, you know, as soon as you have a thought like, isn't that beautiful? Or, how amazing. Actually, you might notice that you suddenly feel a little bit different. You feel a little bit separate. There's a famous koan about this where a teacher and his student are leaving the zendo and they see the moon in the sky, and the student says, isn't that a beautiful moon? And the teacher says, yes, but isn't it a shame to say so? Now, please don't stop yourself from saying, isn't it a beautiful moon, if you think it is, you know. Please don't try to struggle to remain quiet when you're excited about being in the middle of something nice. It's okay to say, those are beautiful flowers. You know, if you say, those are beautiful flowers, other people shouldn't think, oh, you made a big mistake. You know? It's okay, you know. So people who get too serious about Zen get to be a pain in the ass. Right? Yeah. So it's okay to go, that was beautiful, I really liked that, that tasted good, you know. But all the same, when we do begin to exercise a certain kind of mentality, we begin to create a distance between ourselves. And sometimes we need this distance. You know, my father-in-law has been quite ill, and we've taken him to the hospital a number of times. And I think doctors have to kind of stay distant from their patients. You know, if you have somebody who's in a lot of pain, you really have to, you can't sort of like totally empathize with them. You really have to be sympathetic, but a little bit distant, you know. So we need a kind of analytical distance that's necessary, but when it arises, it creates a kind of separation. And so, you know, what we're doing in Zen is really quite important. We're learning how to get in touch with a deeper kind of intelligence that exists all around us in a kind of invisible way. It's not something the discriminating mind can notice. Now, you know, people think, especially Western people, have so much faith in the discriminating mind and in like logic and reason. So I know people who actually believe that everything they do is pretty logical and that it's based upon evidence and reason. You know, but actually, this is like a massive fantasy. So you know, say you know such a person, and you get in the car with him, and you might say, how does a starter work? And the person might say, I don't know. And you say, and yet, you know, you're going to start the car even though you don't know how it really works, you know? And in other words, you know, we depend on the world making sense, but we don't always know why it makes sense. You know, we get in the car, if you're like me, you have no, I know that the car needs gas and it needs an oil change. You know, I open the hood and I look around and I don't know anything in there. I know there's a fan and I know the radiator. I know where the spark plugs are and I know where the oil rod is. But if you said, how does a car work, I could say, well, it sprays gasoline into a cylinder, but I would just be faking it. Right? If you go into the kitchen and you turn on the tap, how does water actually come out of the tap? know, I mean, it does, but how does that happen? You could say, well, the pipes are full of water, and when you open the tap, the water comes out. But actually, that's not an adequate explanation. Right? I mean, you'd have to be a hydraulic engineer or plumber to really explain. You know, if you have, you know, people who think everything they do is logical and rational, it doesn't take long to probe their experience of the world and discover that many of the things that they take a lot on faith, you know, they don't really know a lot. There's a lot of things they don't know. There's a lot of blank areas in their knowledge. And they really don't live in a totally rational world. The rational world is really like this little tiny piece of something larger. And so, you know, all the time as we go through our lives, we're counting on something that we don't understand. Somehow the world fits together in a coherent way. And when it doesn't, we get very nervous sometimes. But a lot of the time, it just seems to work, you know. And I think that on an unconscious level, we're processing information all the time. And the big mind, the unconscious mind, can experience a kind of coherence that the little mind can't experience. And we experience it all the time, you know. So you could be driving down a road one day, and you could turn a corner, and you suddenly look ahead of you, and you might even say, wow, that's beautiful. But it's like you feel totally connected to what you're seeing, you know? And if somebody said, well, what is it that makes you feel so connected? You could say, well, look at those beautiful trees. But you've seen trees before, and they haven't produced this feeling of connection. You know, you could say, well, look at the flowers, you know, look at the sky, it's sunny. But all of those factors have been present in the past, and you haven't always felt this way. There's something going on unconsciously. It's like you have this bigger intelligence that's pulling in all this information, and you turn a corner and suddenly you feel like you're at your long-lost home. And this is a different kind of awareness. Our culture doesn't emphasize it. You know, in something like Japanese culture, people are very sensitive to this. You know, very, very sensitive. If you look at something like Ikebana or like a rock garden, you know, in Ikebana, you're arranging flowers, and you can study books on Ikebana. And they're like abstract principles of asymmetry and so on, and balance. But, you know, if you put the flower here, for some reason it feels better than if you put the flower here. And if you try to explain your decision, you can't. You could invent a reason, but really what's happening is that your big mind is alive and activated. And it's making kind of a decision for you. So you put the flower here and it doesn't, quote, feel right. You put the flower here and it feels right. But if you try to explain it, you can't explain it. Just because you can't explain it in words doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean it's not real. So, you know, if you walk out into a forest and you feel alive and free, and somebody says, why? You know, you could try to offer an explanation, but you don't really, it would just be an invention. Yeah? It's the same thing. You know, basically, if you have to take a pee, you're here on the cushion, and you have to take a pee, and you have to take a pee, and you have to take a pee, and finally the bell rings, and you get up and you take a pee. Sometimes it can be like, oh man, is that great. Yeah? Now, if somebody said, why is it great? You know, you could say, well, I really had to pee. But, you know, actually, you don't need to explain it, you know. You don't need to have a reason for enjoying taking a pee, you know. It's something natural that is part of life, right? And that part of the happiness comes simply from actually being, taking a peek and make you feel deeply connected to the world. You know? One of the things people love most in life is eating. You know? I listen to cooking shows on the radio, and you know, and people will come up with these recipes, and I just think, oh my God, that's fantastic. Eating is one of the foundations of human life. You know, it isn't requiring a lot of, you don't have to defend the fact that you like good food. On a deeper level, the big mind likes to have a good meal, right? And there's a way of cooking that stimulates the senses and makes you feel alive and happy, and makes you feel deeply connected to things around you. You know, a good chef isn't just producing a meal; he's producing connections to the world. You know, so basically, the big mind is the connecting mind. And the little mind is the separating mind. That's a little bit crude, but it's really the way things are. And in Zen, we're learning how to use the connecting mind. One day you go into lunch, and you're just staring at the food, and no words are arising, but you can feel that you're really deeply connected with everything around you. And that's the activation of this other mind, right? It's hard to explain to people who live too much in the small mind, but when we feel connected to the world, we realize that it really is a magical place. It really is a sacred place. I hope you won't mind my saying this. I'm going to end the meditation. Just before I was coming this morning, yesterday morning when I got up, after I sat, I read the Huffington Post, to which I am addicted. And there was a story about the Pope. And the Pope has actually taken the time from his busy schedule to condemn the movie Avatar. I was shocked, you know. And he said, don't think that nature is God. You know, this is paganism, basically. And I was so surprised. I thought, you know, that's amazing that he felt threatened by this movie. But there's something, you know, our Western tradition has created a kind of alienated mind that's very old. It's been, for thousands of years, we've been saying, we're separate from this. You know, we're better than this. And I don't think it would be quite accurate to say nature is God. What I would say is nature is my true self. Everything is my true self. And everything is sacred when I experience it through this other mind, this big mind. And so, in our culture, this is a hard argument to make. Not only because of our religious heritage to some degree, even I mean, if St. Francis of Assisi were around, he wouldn't agree with the Pope, right? So there are people who wouldn't accept what the Pope is saying now. But all the same, we have a heritage of looking at nature as like a second reality. And the technological mindset also encourages this kind of distanced view. So it's hard to explain to people what it's like to experience things in the big mind, but it's quite wonderful. The ocean is the world of dragons. Disappearing and appearing, they sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. So sometimes you go out to the pond and you see a dead fish floating on the pond, and you could say, oh, nature is so cruel. But that's a small mind, right? Small mind. Sometimes you can see a sick bird and think, oh, this is not good, you know. But try experiencing everything through the bigger mind. Maybe it's not the way we think. Yangshan asked a monk, where are you from? The monk said, from Yu province. Yangshan said, what do you think of that place? The monk said, I always think of it. Yangshan said, the thinker is the mind and the thought of is the environment. Herein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls, and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. He says, now, don't stop there, right? Where you say, there's mind and there's world. And there's mind and there's world. That seems obvious. But don't stop there, he says. Look at your own mind. He gives him meditation instructions. He says, when you reverse your thought, and instead of looking at the world, you look at your thoughts, where do you go? And the monk basically says, I go to Muxing. He says, when I go there, I don't see anything at all. Yangshan said, that is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of the person. So when you go to Muxing and you stay there deeply, that's not the end of the path, right? Basically, Yangshan is telling him, when you're in deep Muxing, that's not the final stage. If you stay in Muxing, you begin to experience this connectedness, this living connectedness to everything around you. And you begin to experience this deeper life. So he says, you know, you've gotten into Muxing, so you have a right to wear a robe and be a monk. But now you have to explore the world of form through the eyes of Muxing. And when you, without the eyes of Muxing, everything seems separate. But when we see the world through the eyes of Muxing, everything is connected. And everything is connected because that's the whole picture. It's the form and the no form together. It's like the connection is invisible to the conscious mind. It's all connected, but the connecting element is like water. Right? There's fish in the water. There's something connecting the fish, but we don't know what. If we're fish, we might not notice it's water because it's everywhere. But there's something connecting it all. We just can't, it's like invisible to the discriminating mind. But when we go into Muxing, we begin to experience the world as like a net of Indra, as this interconnection, this living net of jewels, where every moment is like another jewel, mirroring all the other jewels. So we connect through Muxing. And it's a different universe because only the mind of Muxing can experience the connections deeply. So, aren't you glad you came? So please practice today. Go deeply into Muxing and let everything drop away. And then a beautiful world will begin to come to life for all of us.